Good evening, anarchists everywhere, and welcome to Anarchism in the UK. I'm Ian Bone, and tonight's guest is Paul Stott. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome, Ian. Thank you for having me on.
First of all, the news about Prince Harry, a racist, must have come as a bit of a shock.
Absolutely stunned.
Whatever will they tell us next? It's, you know, he's a member of an elitist family or something. It's definitely one for the tabloids.
Indeed. And why is it that the royal family, that there's no more opposition to the royal family in this country? Because, you know, they sit at the peak of a grossly inequitable class system, and they've not exactly endeared themselves to everyone by plotting the murder of Lady Diana, taking a mistress to the wedding and calling your friends packies. Why do you think there isn't a more of a movement against the monarchy?
It's a mixed bag. I think if you... most opinion polls and surveys seem to say 20, 30% of the people just oppose full stop the idea of a royal family or of carrying on with a monarch after the Queen dies. So I think it's one of those areas where politicians are actually out of touch to a degree with a significant number of the people, but probably, sadly, not a majority.
You were involved with movement against the monarchy in that glorious day when a large guillotine was pushed through the streets of London. Well, not a glorious day, a wet day. Ma'am, what did it do and what could it have done, do you think?
Well, Ma'am was an attempt, really, to galvanise the sort of opposition I've just talked about that's latent but isn't always shoved up to the surface. And what you've got to remember with the march against the monarchy, we managed to get, I think, 1,000 people on the streets of London back in 1999 on probably the wettest day London had ever seen. But there were also some good regional events. Lincoln and Bristol, we demonstrated against the Queen, giving out the Maundy money, this really sort of insulting money that's given out to pensioners every year. And we just stood there saying, give us your real money, Mom, etc.
And I think that's one thing you think might rerun this year. You think it'd be good with the recession and all that, give us your real money?
Definitely. If she wants to insult pensioners by giving them plastic coins or whatever, you know, we're in the biggest recession for 70, 80 years. You know, the belt tightening can start at the top, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, especially around the neck. Just also, it's the 640th anniversary of the execution of King Charles II on January 30th, and there's always a bit of a gathering at Banqueting House in Whitehall, so that might be a decent time to raise a few effigies of Prince Harry. OK, thanks for that, Paul. Let's go back to the beginning. How did you get involved in politics in the first place?
Well, I've been involved in the anarchist movement since the early 90s. I joined Class War when I moved down to London in 1992. And I was one of those people, really, been radicalised by the poll tax.
And where were you then when the poll tax came out?
So I was at Wolverhampton Poly, bastion of...
seat of learning.
Precisely, bastion of revolutionary struggle. And I think my own personal background, I mean, I'm Mancunian by birth. Father was from Rochdale, mother from Northern Ireland, from quite a traditional loyalist background. And they'd settled in the respectable suburb of Wimslow in the 1960s. And I think my father rather sort of lived the Thatcherite dream before Mrs. Thatcher set up his own business, left Manchester City Council, where he'd been working as a joiner, and for a few years was a great success. Died suddenly, and of course the business collapsed, everything collapsed, and you're suddenly in an area with very few working class people, with no money, and, you know, sort of the only kid at school getting the free school meals, or, you know, having without a family car, this, that and the other, and you develop class politics at quite an early age in that background.
And did you come across sort of anarchists at Wolverhampton Poly, or was that later when you were on the poll tax demonstrations? Or?
More really from the poll tax stuff. There was a few hunt sabs and a few things going on around, but in those days it was the SWP dominated universities. I mean, we used to hate it at the time. I mean, if you look at students now, there's not even a whiff of radicalism. So you're almost sort of waxing lyrical about those days, which I never thought we would.
So how did you go from sort of a general sort of class consciousness to anarchism? Was there something you read, found, talked to people?
Well, I can remember having a drink in a pub in Kilburn with Tim Scargill, legendary former Class War member in about 1993, and he said, "Oh, why did you join Class War, Paul?" And I think he expected some really sort of profound explanation, and I just said, "Well, I broadly agreed with their politics," and you know, he's really disappointed by that. But particularly if you look back to the poll tax campaign, the anarchists called it right. The sort of Labour left, it was obey the law, vote Neil Kinnock in as Prime Minister, we'll get rid of the poll tax that way. And I mean, we'd have been waiting for many years if we'd taken that route. For the so-called revolutionary left, the explanation really was to force the unions into not collecting, and that the poll tax would be defeated that way. And of course, the unions were never going to obey the law en masse. And what neither group believed was that the working class could deliver, yeah, and that the working class wouldn't pay it. And 40 million people didn't pay, and the poll tax was gone.
And were you on the great event in Trafalgar Square?
No, I went to see Wolverhampton Wanderers versus Leeds, and I'm ashamed to say I was thrown out of the ground. The only time I've ever been thrown out of a football ground, same, which I won't go into. But yeah. So, I was there for the next year for the sort of celebratory efforts, which was a bit more of a damp squib.
It was interesting to see the intro to Tommy Sheridan on Celebrity Big Brother showing footage of the poll tax riot, which, as we all know,
he later grassed up.
Grassed up and asked for the handies. So didn't get mentioned at all. So you got involved in Class Or, and did you find a sort of welcoming way in? I do find when people want to get involved in anarchism, especially in London, it's difficult to find a way in, and it's not, you know, not.
Yeah, it was really strange because I'd moved down to London. I'd got a job working in a library down here, and I didn't really know more than a handful of people. And I can remember writing into Class War, and eventually some sort of reply came, and I met a couple of people in some seedy pub in Holloway. But the first meeting I went to was in a pub in King's Cross, and I was late. I'd been at work, and this was when King's Cross was King's Cross, not the sort of yuppified area it is now. And I went into the bar, and there's two sort of ladies of ill repute who looked me up and down with sort of complete...
This is an excellent organisation.
Well, yeah, yeah. And, so I asked them where the meeting was, and they must have thought that was a sort of poor chatting line.
The meeting, you say?
I've heard it called that before, yeah. And scurried upstairs, and everybody sort of looks over their pints at you in a sort of really sort of calculating way. But... Class War in the early 90s was an interesting group because, you know, you'd had all the success around the poll tax, and I think both Class War and the anarchist movement in general, there was the sort of search for the next big thing, for sort of poll tax Mark II. And, of course, it wasn't found, and what you had then was people sort of dissipated and wandered off in different directions. And
did, at the same time as you were discovering Class War, did you start to sort of read the anarchist holy text? Did you go back and read your Bakunin and Kropotkin and loads of anarchist history? Or
no, I think I've got a natural aversion to men with beards. My mother taught me they were always trying to hide something. So
and women with beards.
Even worse. I mean, Class War was the only political organisation I've ever been in. I had a couple of years as a trade union official, and I think although people might not recognise it, you do actually have quite a good political education from being in Class War, but it was nearly always from reading Unfinished Business and looking at contemporary authors, and I rather left the 19th century alone, to be honest. And even more recent things like, you know, The Platform, which is a really rated document by some left communists. I've never read it.
Oh, good grief. A terrible admission by Paul Stott, live on Resonance. He's never read the Makhnovist programme for The Platform of Anarchists in Ukraine in 1924. That'll stun the movement. Well, the strength of Class War, I guess, I mean, were a couple of things. But the paper, can you just talk us through why the paper was so good when it was good and why it had such a wide appeal and went beyond the sort of sales of other lefty anarchist papers?
Well, I think it still does today, although you're talking about greatly reduced numbers across the board, really. But I think with Class War as an organisation, there was always an attempt to do something, to push things. There was a sense of purpose. And really, that was reflected in the paper. It championed resistance. It put things in a broadly accessible manner. But we also looked at things, you know, such as sport and the politics of sport that other left groups were just completely ignorant of.
So an attempt really to create a sort of anarchist tabloid to some extent. Do you think that's a possibility? The one of the failures of the left in general has been its inability to produce anything like a mass circulation paper. To envisage a movement without a paper, to me, is ridiculous. But, I mean, can you see any possibilities of, say, Class All getting its circulation back up to what it used to be? Or?
I think it's harder now than ever before, really. I mean, I think with the summer issue, we did 2,000 copies, which, you know, is a lot lower than when you were working on it in its peak. Mm. That's probably greater than all the other anarchist publications in the UK put together. And, you know, that sold well, but it sold well through people going around all the sort of summer festivals, events, and flogging it. If people hadn't done that, would those you know, the people who bought it have been demanding their paper. Probably not. They get the news from the internet, or they do an house.
You've also had the decline of the radical bookshop, haven't you? And it's just, I mean, what you've got, Housemans and Freedom and in London, that's your lot. So there's just no outlet for.
Yeah, and some really good bookshops, like, you know, the Manchester Frontline, you know, places like that, gone, really.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, you wonder even about the success in the future of places like Housemans, when it's just so much cheaper to buy from Amazon, and we can come out with our own critiques of Amazon and whatever, but it's all down to Dosh in the end.
Yeah. What about other anarchist organisations? Anyone try and poach you away from Class War?
I've never been offered a transfer fee, so I don't know if I should take that as a...
Headhunted by the Anarchist Federation.
So...
Right, the question is, Paul, everyone asks, wouldn't it be a lot better if we were all in the same organisation, all work together, and we put away these 10 different splinter organisations?
Yes.
And the way to get there is? And the reason we don't is?
The reason you don't, historically, is some of the differences in the movement mattered more to people than anything else. You know, you've got to have the correct line on Ireland, or you've got to have the correct line on trade unions. And I think the frustrating thing for me as a member of Class War is there's always been people in Class War who've had the same view as the Anarchist Federation on Ireland, or the same view as the Solidarity Federation on trade unions. And they're able to have those politics in Class War where perhaps other members strongly disagreed. There's always been a current of Irish republicanism within Class War. We could perhaps let those differences go. Other groups perhaps hang more strongly onto those. I also think there's a debate around the A word, about anarchism per se. I mean, you mentioned the Anarchist Federation and their great success, their great appeal. It's quite simple. They've got the word anarchist in their title. So every generation of 18, 19-year-olds who decide, you know, get up one day and decide I'm an anarchist, that's the group they look to. Yeah. And it's got its sort of international orthodoxy and whatever. So it brings people in. But whether or not it then maintains them and, you know, keeps them in the movement, it's been far less successful at that. And my own personal view is you can't, in this day and age, sell an ism, a sort of ready-wrapped ideology, to Joe and Josephine Public. It just ain't going
to
work.
You have to buy into the entire history, don't you, as well? I mean, Class War did make that attempt not to be. It didn't always call itself anarchist. It dropped the circled A's and so on. But in the wider, the decline of the left as well. None of the lefty organisations are doing. They're all imploding from respect and this, that and the other. The campaign for a Marxist party couldn't even get a campaign off the ground for a Marxist party, leave alone a Marxist party. So it's across the board, it seems. Within our own working class, there's very little signs of fight back at the moment, are there?
No, I mean, just to say on the wider left, I can remember talking to Larry O'Hara about this. He was a Green Party member, and he told me how he was delighted when the Communist Party sort of collapsed, and he thought this is so marvellous, the sort of dead hand of Stalinism won't hold the left back anymore. Of course, the reality was it wasn't really replaced by anything better, and people either just sort of dissipated nothing really came through. And I think in the working class in general, there's a general feeling of a sort of loose depression or a feeling, you know, if I knocked on every door on my estate and asked people what they thought of Hackney Council, they'd all say, you know, just come out with abuse and say how awful they are. If I asked those same people, do they want to do something or do anything, I strongly suspect everybody would say no, that people don't feel any change can come about. We're rather, you know, like a dog with its tail between its legs, you know. Yeah.
Well, and also the unions, I mean, we were faced with a recession and waves of redundancies. I mean, we all know the unions are just sort of mediators between the bosses and the workers. But during this present recession, there doesn't any resistance to redundancies at all. You know, apart from getting you 2 days at a health farm and selling you a porcelain ornament or something, the unions seem to have lost any purpose whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I was a branch official in the old CPSA in the mid-90s, and I learnt quite a lot from it. And I think, in a way, yes, you can criticise the unions, Ian, but What I did find was with the members, a lot of people would vote for me in union elections or look to me, knowing I was a member of Class War, and some of the people who were, you know, involved, there was a guy in the Socialist Party, etc. And they wouldn't dream of supporting your organisation if you stood in an election, or, you know, if you were trying to sell them books, magazines, whatever, but they wanted to know there was somebody in that office who would knock on the boss's door and say, Derek, you're a so-and-so. Yeah. And they knew a member of Class War would do that. They didn't necessarily want to knock on the boss's door themselves and say, Derek, you're a so-and-so. So there's just that issue, really, around, you know, you doing things for people, and that was one of the things that I left trade union activism with. There's a problem there. You know, we want people to do it for themselves, and perhaps we're going to have to wait a little bit longer for that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we don't seem to have the sort of the stroppy anti-authoritarianism of the Greeks or some of the other Europeans at the moment when they're on the street at the job of a hat, or even the French. Seems to sort of be vanishing from our sort of culture. I mean, one of the problems with the implosion of the left and is the growth, the corresponding growth of the BNP. You've written about that in the BNP and articles in Black Flag and so on. And there's been a lot of discussion around the abandonment of the white working class and so on. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the BNP did something that the anarchist movement thus far has been incapable of doing, of having a debate and a discussion, deciding what it wanted to do, and then doing it. And you had a process around about the time Nick Griffin joined the BNP that ran for 2 or 3 years. You had the Identity magazine that Tony Lacomba edited, and they debated their direction. They decided to move into a sort of Euro-nationalist position, to drop the more over Nazism, fascism. And I think probably the most important change they made was to drop the commitment to compulsory repatriation, which had always put a lot of people off the far right. And it basically meant people could now vote BNP who had black friends or who had a distant black relative or who fancied the Asian woman in the corner shop. And they didn't feel they were sending those people to the gas chambers, which perhaps under John Tyndall's BNP, you were voting to do that. Mm. And the BNP were also assisted by the decline of the left, by the Labour Party's move into the sort of centre ground, and really by the Tory Party also moving into that centre ground. So there's nobody on the left and there's nobody on the right in a lot of communities. So the BNP are kicking at an open goal, I'm afraid, at the moment.
Especially in those sort of Labour Party heartlands where they've taken the grant of people like Stoke-on-Trent and stuff like that, where they've taken that the white working class will roll out and vote Labour whatever happens, and finding that's not happening.
Yeah, eventually, if you treat everybody with contempt for long enough, then the message rather sinks in. Yeah. And particularly the case with New Labour, where you look at so many of the sort of big cheeses in New Labour, MPs for constituencies in the northeast of England, and they've done absolutely nothing for those constituencies.
Well, especially those sort of Ed Balls, Yvette Cooper types who've been parachuted in, you know, from the south of England to seats like Normanton and Yorkshire, where they've got no possible local connection. I mean, how do you say? I mean, you've written a couple of articles for Black Flag about the BNP. Tell us about them.
Well, myself and Kieran from Bristol, I mean, we wanted to set out the fact that BNP had gone through this process, had changed its political colour ever so slightly, but they had a strategy, that they had a structure, that they were trying to deliver something. And we might not agree with the answers that they offer, but they do at least offer answers. And I think our concern is that the anarchist movement, apart from a sort of vague call to solidarity with whoever, we don't really offer that much in the way of practical solutions, other than everything will be all right when there's a revolution or whatever. And we're not in a revolutionary situation, Ian. So that was one of the things that I think we wanted to get across. We also wanted to offer some critique of Islamism per se, that we didn't feel people on the left or in the anarchist movement were confident about doing. And as we know, the political establishment, I think, really is divided about Islam. You'll see some very racist articles, some nasty knocking pieces. But also you've got, you know, Prince Charles wanting to be the defender of all faiths, and the Labour Party getting into bed with a succession of Muslim organisations. Yeah. And we felt people on the left needed to offer some critique and to raise the flag for secular values. You know, anarchists used to have the League of Militant Atheists, and we've rather forgotten those days. So we weren't comfortable with a society where the only people really knocking religion were on the right, and I think we wanted to you know, get our two penneth in from a class struggle anarchist perspective.
Yeah, I mean, given the popularity of Richard Dawkins' stuff, you think a sort of popular movement against religion. I mean, even Dawkins is sticking adverts on buses. But you were telling me earlier about that Nicholas Walter and a couple of other anarchists had actually been attacked at Speaker's Corner by Islamists.
Well, this was way back in the day. I mean, the origins of British Islamism, which nobody really likes to to talk about, really go back to the Salman Rushdie affair. The concept of a Muslim community per se wasn't talked about in the 70s. People talked about, you know, British Asians, black community, this, that and the other. And it was only really from the Rushdie affair, and particularly Dr. Siddiqui's agitation at the time, calling for Rushdie's death, circulating photocopies of the satanic verses, sending them off to the Ayatollahs in Iran, etc. And when they had the big march, a sort of Death to Salman Rushdie march in London, Nicholas Walls, a rather venerable and perhaps harmless old anarchist, was at Speaker's Corner with some of the old...
Increasingly brave, in my estimation.
Yeah, but him and some of the other sort of old-style secular activists, Barbara Smoker and co, were at Speaker's Corner, sort of supporting Rushdie, and got a good kicking for their trouble, I'm afraid. And I mean, perhaps, yeah, perhaps then... You know, a few people on sort of the left, the anarchist movement, should perhaps have wised up to some of the issues that were bubbling underneath, really.
You've caused quite a lot of controversy, if not in some places, even on my blog, with your views of where the anarchist movement should go, and taking apart some of this with some fairly heretical views of that basically a lot of the stuff that anarchists do is useless and doesn't correspond into ordinary people's experience. You've talked about, you know, animal rights, asylum seekers, and the fact that basically anarchism doesn't address your own issues, where you're coming from, and ordinary people's. I mean, is it, you know, and then there's a knee-jerk reaction against that, calling you all sorts of stuff. How do you feel that debate could go?
I think actually, in a way, we shouldn't be so negative about ourselves, in that, you know, there is a debate there. I think some of the arguments on both sides have actually been quite good, and I could very easily, you know, if you look at sort of the wider left, you probably couldn't have that debate at all in some of the trade unions or the old style CPGB or Socialist Workers Party, etc. And I'm not really sure personally how much work anarchists can do around the issue of asylum seekers. I'm not saying that work's necessarily wrong, but you've got to fight battles that you can win where you can make a difference. And I think left liberal politics ultimately is far better done by left liberals than by anarchists. And you also have to look at the wider issue. Can everybody who wants to live in Britain come and live here tomorrow? I mean, I've travelled a lot in Southeast Asia and different parts of the world. Virtually everybody under 30 who could speak English would come here tomorrow if they could. Is that desirable? You know, the best people leave Thailand, Malaysia, India or whatever to come here. Is that good for those countries?
Yeah, I mean, all the doctors come here and they don't leave any living there, yeah. There's always attempts to recreate the anarchist movement. There was a conference when class war ended, well, a version of class war ended 10 years or so ago, and then they followed up by a Bradford conference when everything was up for grabs, think the unthinkable, imagination will seize power and we'll all go forward. And now there's another possibility of a repeat conference of that 10 years later this year. Are there any hopes of that? Did the Bradford thing lead anywhere, in your opinion?
Well, I didn't go to the Bradford events. I mean, I'd been in class war with some of the people who wanted to set that event up, and they made it very plain. They didn't want the likes of me there, etc. And they sort of went off on their own little routes, which came to nothing. And I think it's always a big mistake in politics to confuse your own sort of personal circumstances or problems with wider political questions. And put simply, a lot of those people were tired of being in class war, didn't want to edit the class war newspaper anymore, and rather than simply, you know, leaving and going to do something else, they talked about how they wanted to reforge the anarchist movement but weren't willing to do the nitty-gritty and the hard toil on it. So not surprisingly, it came to nothing. And I mean, the idea of sort of something 10 years on, where is the structure? What is there to build from Bradford 90? And the answer is nothing. So
also, it's really difficult to overcome sort of small group loyalty as well, because I've talked to several people in other anarchist organisations in the last few weeks, and everything's fine. Their membership's brilliant, and they're doing really well, and someone's joined there. You know, when the reality doesn't, their sort of vision of reality doesn't correspond with what you see. But there's this, we are the right way. It's a really hard way to get over.
Yes, it's always tempting to announce that you're the biggest midget in the circus, but the fact is you're still a midget, you know, and that's always that. I mean, I'm not a member of Class War anymore. I've been a member for 16 years, and it's time I did something else now.
Yeah, you've got the long service medal.
So I suppose so, but yeah, I've done the same things for long enough, really, and some of the people can take the baton on. But
so what are you, I mean, you've mentioned Islamism and the stuff you've been writing around that and thinking about that. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I got made redundant at the end of 2005, and after wasting some of my time, I went back into education, got a master's degree in terrorism studies, oddly enough, and I'm doing...
There's terrorism studies?
There certainly is.
I thought that's the kind of thing you got arrested for studying.
Terrorology,
so
I
when you look that up on the internet, you just say it's for research purposes.
Obviously, yeah, I'm expecting the door to go through any morning.
I'm in terrorism studies. I knew you could do peace studies. They both run at the same university.
Well, you do peace studies, you can do war studies, you know, it's whatever tickles your fancy. But, one of the things I've wanted to do is to look seriously at the rise of sort of British Islamism and British jihadism. And it actually goes back well before the invasion of Afghanistan or the invasion of Iraq, which is a sort of left liberal myth, really, that this is just a sort of response to the West's terror. That's a factor, but, you know, you can go back instead to British Muslims travelling to Afghanistan, to Kashmir, to fight in the 1990s. In the early 90s, going to Bosnia to fight. So this trend's actually been there for some time, and people in the anarchist movement, people in the left, entirely ignorant of it, really. So I want to do some more studies, research in that area. And
with a view to publishing stuff? Or?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, if you said to me 10 years ago that I'd be involved in academia, I'd have said you were joking, you know. So you don't know what's going to happen next, what's going to come up. But, I mean, I did the 9 to 5, Monday to Friday work for 12, 13 years, and I think it'd kill me to go back. So I'm going to do whatever gets me out, really. So we'll see, Ian. We'll see.
In general, with about 4 minutes left, for the future this coming year, I mean, you know, if there was a wish list of things that could happen, or do you feel optimistic about the coming year? We got the G20 summit in London in April, which I go, there'll be sort of Euro demonstrators coming over here, but that's, you know, a bit like the old style summit hopping. As we said before, the recession seems to be just washing over people's heads. In fact, some people are benefiting from the 99p a pint at Wetherspoons.
Well, you are, but...
feeding yourself, no doubt. I mean, can you give us some optimism about the coming year politically?
Well, I've been very impressed by what happened in Greece. I think we need some of that, you know, combativity and an attitude here. I suspect some of the European anarchos coming over may be a bit disappointed when they land in London in April. But I think as a strategy, that sort of summit hopping or big set-piece confrontations, that failed, and we learnt that really with May Day. So I don't think that's necessarily the way forward. The recession stuff, perhaps it hasn't bitten yet, but it will. And I'm actually quite pessimistic about how things are going to go. And I mean, to return to the terrorism point, I think, you know, I've been saying for years before 7/7 that there would be terrorist attacks in the UK. They'd be carried out by British Muslims, and things could get very nasty. And I fear you will have a repeat of that type of incident as well. So I'm a pessimist rather than an optimist, but I do believe that the type of class struggle politics that both of us have always believed in, that is going to be one of the few solutions in the future, because the other solutions are all worse, quite frankly, and have all failed already.
And you've got to, I mean, one of the bad things, I guess, is that we end up just celebrating different anniversaries all year for the lack of anything going on in the present. But it's the 25th anniversary of the miners' strike, so it's going to be quite a contrast between the sort of naked class struggle of Thatcherism and the sort of lack of class struggle now.
Yes, but I do think with the miners' strike, really, we need to just put our hands up and say the war's over, the good guys lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can fiddle around far too much commemorating this, that and the other.
Well, it seems to be like there's a general retreat into radical history, I think, because there's nothing going on in the present, so people are forming, you know, discovering even more stuff to commemorate in the past. I mean, you're one of the writers as well. I mean, have you got anything planned in writing? Is there a book in there somewhere?
So there may well be on the history of British jihadism. I've been doing some work with Larry O'Hara around the 9/11 loonies, the sort of silly conspiracy theories about 9/11. I believe Bin Laden did it broadly, and that's really the end of the matter. I do think if I made one contribution in the anarchist movement in the past few years, it's been perhaps, you know, right, showing a firm hand to some of this nonsense, which is attempting to infiltrate the anti-war movement and really needs to be sort of swatted away quite firmly, I'm afraid.
Well, let's end on one Desert Island Disc kind of question. What's your favourite anarchist book?
Well, I can't say one of yours. That would be far too...
it says in front of you.
That would be far too grovelly.
Well, perhaps I'll just say your favourite book.
Favourite book? I should say E.P. Thompson,
You can't go far wrong with E.P. Thompson. No. He was quoted widely in The Guardian yesterday by someone asking what's happened to working class struggle. Okay, thanks a lot, Paul. That was really informative, as always. Touched a lot of bases there. And we'll have another Anarchism in the UK next week.